Audrey H. Rubin is president and founder of Rubin Solutions LTD. She designs and implements business processes which improve the financial performance and operations of corporate law departments and professional services firms. She talks with Ed about what lawyers need to know before they open their own law firm. In today's world, this is a topic of great interest, especially to those increasing numbers of law school graduates who are starting their own practices right out of school. You can learn more about Audrey at www.rubinsolutions.com. That's RubinSolutions.com.
Audrey, thanks for joining us today. I look forward to our conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ed.
One of the things that I know you work, one of the areas I know that you work in, and one of the things that's, I think, quite important in today's world is the idea for lawyers to start their own law firms. And I think before lawyers do that, there should be some questioning that they have of themselves and maybe of others. What would you suggest lawyers should ask themselves before they decide to open up their own law firm?
Yeah, well, certainly running your own firm, opening your own firm means you're an entrepreneur. And you really have to analyze whether you have that entrepreneurial demeanor. That means you're going to be getting the business. You and other people you hire are going to be servicing the business. You may not be the direct manager. You may hire a chief operating officer or an office administrator or a consultant. But at the end of the day, it is your business. And so you're going to be making business decisions. So you really have to feel comfortable doing that. And then, of course, there's the entrepreneurial risk. You know, you're not getting a steady paycheck anymore. If the money comes in and the expenses are low, you can put some money in your personal wallet. Otherwise, you can't. So I would say you really have to decide whether you want to be a business owner and an entrepreneur.
Well, let me ask you a question concerning that, because I taught entrepreneurship at the university level for 30 years. And one of the things that's interesting to me is the concept that you raise, which is risk. And if you're a partner in a larger law firm, you get a draw, and yet it comes every week or every other week or once a month, but you're not guaranteed to have the full benefit of the profitability, assuming the firm's profitable, until somewhere later in the year. How is that different for the partner in a mid-sized or larger firm than it is for the entrepreneur, as you define him or her, in the smaller firm?
Yeah, you make a good point. Especially in today's world, many people will say, well, there's risk even with the largest firms, or there's risk even with the most senior equity partners. But this is a different kind of risk. These are business decisions that you're going to have to take risks on. Unless you were a managing partner or very, very much involved in running a firm, you didn't have to decide if it was worth taking down the line of credit, if it was a good idea to take more space or not. You probably didn't have to choose who was going to be running your office, how much malpractice insurance to get and what variables there will be, deductibles and so forth. You probably didn't have to figure out what colors you wanted the stationery to look like and how you're going to have to do that. And to be a business person means you can't agonize over everything or else you'll never get anything done. You have to be willing to make mistakes and take some risks. Some of that is not it's not the way lawyers like to be or have been trained to be, which is why in some instances lawyers need to be coached through opening their own business.
Well, it's quite clear that law school did not prepare us for doing any of the things you mentioned, whether they be in a small firm or a large firm. What are some of the critical topics that a lawyer has to handle before opening the law firm?
Yeah, well, very...
Aside from the paint and color and so forth.
Right, no, before that, you have to do a good business plan. And I really do mean a good business plan. Many of my clients, as you know, I help a lot of firms launch. Many of my clients kind of write out it in two paragraphs or five paragraphs, what they hope to do and who they hope to do it with, and they think they're off and running. You have to do that high-level business plan, but you really have to dig deeper, too. You have to do budgets. You have to do realistic budgets based on what clients you think are coming with you, how much those clients really pay, how quickly they pay. You have to do cash flow analyses because, again, you can't rely on 50 other partners in the building to be getting that cash in the door. It's you and a few others. So you have to do very solid business planning. And because this isn't where many lawyers are trained, I strongly advocate hiring somebody like you or me to help them out. The other thing that you really have to do is get some ethics advice. In virtually all of the states, there are certain things you cannot say to clients. You can't say to staff in your existing law firm if you're currently employed. And certain things that you must be careful not to do. And I'd hate for anybody to open up a firm only to be, you know, hit with a temporary restraining order or something because they blew one of these ethical tenets. So I would say finance and business plans are number one. Ethics is very close behind it.
In other words, they need to buy my books.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I like the idea of the ethics advice because we're all, benefit of the doubt, we're all ethical. But here it's not just a question of ethics, it's a question of following the rules of professional conduct, which is something that goes beyond or in some cases doesn't even reach the level of ethics that I think we think about when we talk about, when we use that word. And so determining what the appropriate rules of professional conduct will allow us to do as we depart our old firm or as we start up coming from a new environment, I think is very, very good advice.
That's right. States even have different rules on what names you can use in the new firm and how you can hold yourself out. So that's exactly right. I would say right behind all of these would be your brand. And I know lawyers don't like to think that they're in marketing or selling soap so that they need a brand. But in fact, they do. This goes into the business plan. There's no point opening up your firm if you don't know who you're going to be and who your clients are going to be. So you really do have to think about why are clients going to come to me? What's my pitch going to be? What am I going to look like? Am I going to be charging a lower rate than the large firm? Is that my angle? Am I going to be providing more direct service without lots of associates? Is that my angle? Am I a specialist in a certain area of law? Is that my angle? You really have to figure that out so that then you can build everything else in your business around your brand.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting because I had a conversation with a client of mine on several of those points this very morning. Knowing what you're doing and why you're doing it is important, and if you're starting to compete based on price and price alone, you're in trouble.
I'll give you another example, and I'm sure you've run into this. If you're going to make yourself a smaller firm, you came from a large firm, there's a group of you spinning out to start your own firm, and you feel that you'll be able to bring clients with you, and you feel that you'll be able to charge a lower rate, now you have to ask, am I going to go to less expensive office space?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I want to look like I'm, you know, full of mahogany and portraits on the walls, even though I'm small? So these are the kinds of things that go into who am I and what am I doing and how am I holding myself out to the clients.
Absolutely. Well, let me, since we touched the issue of finance, what kind of reserve would you suggest that a lawyer have, financial reserve, before moving out? And if the lawyer does not have that financial reserve, what would be the alternative you would suggest?
Well, that's an interesting question. In many cases, the bank is going to help you here, or the landlord. In many cases, you won't be able, well, first of all, you probably won't be able to get a lease unless you have a line of credit with a recognized bank. In order to get the line of credit with the recognized bank, you're going to have to show them a solid business plan and some collateral, which is more than just accounts receivable, since you don't have any accounts receivable yet that the bank can trust. So banks will vary on this. Some of them will take a 6 month, you know, show that you can float for, that you can make it for 6 months. Some of them will require key person insurance on the biggest rainmakers if they feel that, in fact, the clients are going to come with people. Some landlords are going to require solvency for a year. So for an ongoing business, a law firm, the rule of thumb is that you have to be able to meet 3 to 4 months of payroll. You got to have that cash in the bank. I don't mean collateralized. I mean cash in the bank, liquid. For an upstarting business, I think you need a little bit more than that.
And if you don't have that, what's the recommendation, assuming that you either have to get out or you want to get out from where you are now?
Well, to be sure that you have ready access of liquid funds through loans, through families, through your home mortgage, through your credit card, because the key is, in the context of what we're talking, you have to get by in the beginning. Before your bills are actually out the door, you're going to have expenses. So you really have to be sure that you have a source of liquidity, even if you feel that things are going to go swimmingly 6 or 8 or 9 months down the road. You have to have liquidity in the beginning to get yourself up and operating. Then, of course, if you're going to have partners, they can help capitalize the firm too.
2 points I want to chime in here on. One is that it's like building a house. It always takes twice as long to get where you want to be, and it always costs you twice as much
anticipated.
So be careful. And I guess the alternative to that is bite your lip and stay where you are until you can build the reserve that you're talking about. And also with respect to partners, there's a concept in law called joint and several liability, but you need to know who your partners are and what their financial reserves are if you anticipate that they are literally going to be backing you up.
Good point.
So let's move on a little bit and ask the question, okay, I want to do this. I think I have the financial strength to do so. Can I do it on my own? Do I have to have help? You mentioned hiring staff. What kind of staff should I hire? What kind of advisors and consultants and coaches and whomever and whatever else do you think I need to get involved and play with me in the sandbox?
Yeah, I'm going to respond by saying two things that are consistent even though they sound inconsistent. One is anybody can do it alone. The other is nobody can do things alone. So here's what I mean by that. Anybody can be a sole practitioner if you have the temperament and the ability to go get clients and do the work. So it's a question of your temperament as much as anything and your ability to attract clients. But nobody should do things alone that they're not skilled in or that they need advice for. So, you know, the greatest Olympic athletes have lots and lots of coaches, lawyers, and business people need coaches too. If you're going to open up your own firm, you're going to need people to help you do the clerical work, people to help you do the financial setups, the bills. You're going to need people to help you do your filings. You're not always going to be able to get to a court or the Secretary of State's office if you're only one person. You need more systems to cover you when you're not physically available. The other thing you need if you're a sole practitioner, I call it the bench strength. You need other people you can call. Lawyers should not, as a rule, be handling significant decisions and significant matters without bouncing ideas off of other people, especially if they're junior, if they're shortly out of law school. You need to figure out who you can call and maybe pay to help you with a matter so that you're not making bad decisions.
Well, that kind of raises an interesting question that I have discussed often with solo practitioners, some of whom are truly solo, and others who are sole proprietors but have other folks around them. And that is the old John Donne poem, part of which goes, "No man is an island." And I think, to follow what you're saying, is that lawyers miss the boat when they fail to get a coterie of lawyers in other specialties in their network.
Or it, even in their specialty, to bounce ideas off of, to collaborate with. And a sole practitioner who thinks he or she should spend his or her time getting files set up and doing conflict searches and issuing invoices and following up on those invoices is probably making a bad judgment call. There are other people who are better at those things than you are. You should be out there servicing your clients and getting new ones.
Yeah, it's, my philosophy is you have only two things the lawyer should be doing. One is getting the work, because only you know if you're competent to handle it, and only you know if you want to deal with this particular client. And the other thing is that you should be doing the work, because only you are licensed to do the work. Everything else can and should be done by somebody else. But we talk a lot about clients in our conversation. Obviously, you can't start a new firm unless you have clients. And so the question becomes, how much can you share with clients or with other people that you'd like to bring with you while you're still engaged elsewhere?
Well, this gets back to checking your rules of professional conduct. In most states, there's very little you can share with employees or clients.
It's called, competing with your employer.
Yeah.
There's another phrase that escapes me at the moment. It was right on the tip of my tongue.
Right. Well, there could be tortious interference claims.
There you go.
There could be also assertions of breach of fiduciary responsibility, and that's how this is how those would run. Your client is a client of ABC Large Firm. ABC Large Firm has a fiduciary duty to represent that client and with zeal and all of the other things that the rules of the professional conduct require. If you tell your client that you're about to leave, it then divides or could divide the fiduciary duty or undermine it. And so you have all sorts of other problems there.
You know, tortious interference with contractual relations can become really messy.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, most law firms don't sue. It sort of becomes, it's almost a way of life, a way of thinking that, okay, every lawyer is an individual, even though within a firm, and if they leave, we're expecting that we're going to lose some business. And some firms go the extra mile and say, no, that's not true, you know, we're going to fight. And the problem with fighting is the client turns around and says, a pox on both your houses. I'll go get a third lawyer. I don't need either one of
you. That's right, but, you know, there have been firms that have sued over this, and what they sue on is not only tortious interference, but they sue because you've breached your fiduciary duty to the firm and your other partners
right.
by luring away a client while you were still a partner at their firm.
Well, let's go back to the high road and assume that if you are going to leave, and if you leave, you've told these folks just before you've left so that there's no real, as Chick Hearn used to say, no harm, no foul, and certainly you're not going to get into a lawsuit over it, and you're now up and running. Two questions. One, how long is this planning process? I mean, you're going to be thinking about it for quite a while. You're going to do some planning. You're going to take some actions to get going, because if you leave on a Friday, you have to have some place to go on a Monday.
Right.
What's the time frame? What can you do while you're still at the old facility, the old law firm? And how long will it take you once you've decided to make the move to when you can open up your own doors?
Well, the answer to that is how well you want to do it. If you want to walk into a space on Monday with some computers that work and phones that work and some ability to actually provide client services, maybe a coffee maker, you're going to need more lead time than if you kind of just walk out on a Friday and work from home on Monday. So it's a question of the way in which you want to leave. My recommendation for a way to do it best is 2.5 to 3 months. I've done it for clients in 2.5 months very effectively. 3 months would have even been better. And you can do it less. I mean, I opened up an office once for somebody in a week, literally in a week. But it was pretty crazy, and there were a lot of bodies poured on this project to get their space and get it furnished and up and operating.
I suppose one way to approach it, in addition to what you've said, of actually leaving today and taking a hiatus for 2-3 months or however long, is to engage somebody else to do it while you're still working and have somebody else do all the physical tasks short of the marketing, and you wait for your marketing so you don't get locked into this fiduciary interference and other claims of misdoing. And start it that way.
Yeah, that's why I'm there. Thank you very much for the plug, Ed.
There you go.
That's exactly why people hire me.
There you go.
I can help them find their space, take care of their insurance, do a search for staff, do all of that stuff so they can keep practicing law, keep their clients happy in the meantime, and, you know, Monday morning the place is ready to go and open for them to operate.
Okay, now let's ask the last question, and that is, you're up and running. You're doing marketing. Let's say you actually get some work. Now you're doing the work. How long will it be, do you think, before you can make a judgment that you're successful or you've made a mistake?
You know, everybody has a different point in which they feel that they're suffering. But I would say that you can't expect to really be profitable and successful in less than 2 years, especially in this economy. You can hope to make ends meet. You can hope to break even. But I don't think most people in this economy walk out and say, wow, I'm making more money than I ever made before. Look at all these profits in less than 2 years. That's just my rule of thumb. It can be done differently, certainly, but 2 years is when you really start to feel you understand your business, you understand how it operates, you understand where the clients are coming from, you have kind of a steady cash flow.
Well, you are far more optimistic than I. In all my courses at the university, I was very proud to say that 2 to 3 new businesses started in my classes on average, and my experience both in the industrial service and professional service world was that the answer to my question is more closely aligned to 5 years, when you can really kind of take a sigh and say, you know, we made it.
Okay.
We cleared the hurdles. We are competitive with others within the profession. And, yeah, there'll be ups and downs and so forth, but we made it. I think it's more like 5 years. Yes, as you say, maybe it's 1 year, maybe it's 2 years, maybe it's some other number. But I don't think you ought to go into it thinking that within 60 to 90 days you're going to be a success and be stable for the next 10, 20 years of your career.
Oh, that's exactly right. That would be a miracle.
Well, Audrey, thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate your insight, and I concur with you that it's a challenge in today's economy, but then it's always been a challenge.
That's right, and with proper planning and proper help, it can be really a great opportunity for a lot of people.
Amen.
Thank you, Ed, very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. You can read more about this and other topics from the business of law at www.lawbizblog.com, or start your own discussion about this topic at www.lawbizforum.com. Join today. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz Podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.